from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As our climate changes, so does our health. Health researchers are warning of serious risks that go along with a warming planet, including a longer, more intense allergy season, higher risk of disease from smoke and air pollution, and intensified mental health issues due to extreme heat and climate anxiety. In this hour, we discuss the toll that climate change may have on our society's physical and mental health. And that's all next. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We know that climate change is severely affecting the health of our planet. It's also affecting our health. A warmer planet means a longer allergy season and higher air pollution. Periods of extreme hot weather can trigger congestive heart failure, worsen kidney conditions, and exacerbate mental health issues. And there is the anxiety and distress that can come with a rapidly changing environment. Joining us to discuss the toll climate change can take on our mental and physical health is Paul Auerbach. He's professor emeritus of emergency medicine at Stanford, at the University Medical Center, and also co-author of Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And welcome, Professor Auerbach. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you.
Good morning to you. And we also want to welcome Robin Cooper, who's here with us in studio, a psychiatrist in private practice in San Francisco and co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us here. And Dr. Auerbach, let me begin with you, and let's begin by just talking about what we know generally at this point. We know certainly that extreme weather and sea level rise are really affecting all kinds of illnesses and creating all kinds of problems in our physical health. Sketch that out for us, if you could.
The list of health-related effects from climate change are is enormous. There are the obvious that you mentioned, the heat waves, the heat stress, the extreme weather events, floods, hurricanes, etc. But there are many others that haven't come to the forefront yet, like the migration of vectors like mosquitoes and other creatures that cause communicable diseases that will move as the planet warms. You have a superb mental health expert on the show with us, which is terrific because there are profound mental health effects. And then all the issues related to lack of access to clean water, migration of people, food security, the issue of increased allergic exposures, the harmful algal blooms that we're seeing from microorganisms that are proliferating in the ocean, and then the broader range of problems that will relate eventually to lack of biodiversity, to the erosion of ecosystem services, all the interrelationships and how it all winds in. So it's quite an impressive list.
And an overwhelming list in many ways. I mean, one is staggered at just all of the things that can result or that can be consequential from climate change. And you mentioned mental health. Let's bring Robin Cooper into this. What are the main things you find and that you really need citizens to be aware of in terms of the effect and impact on mental health, Robin Cooper?
Well, let me start first with just kind of alerting people. Climate change is a health emergency. It's a mental health emergency and a health emergency. And I think in regards to the mental health impacts, people tend to think about the kind of things that you can easily relate to, how traumatic the post-traumatic stress syndromes and depression when people lose huge amounts of things in their lives due to the enormous weather-related disasters. So what we know about the wildfires, what we know about floods, what we know about the impact from hurricanes. It's the post-traumatic stress is enormous. What I think is much, much less understood are that there are profound behavioral thinking problems, psychiatric problems that are specifically related just to heat extremes themselves, to air pollution that people tend to think about air pollution as affecting their asthma, lung disease, but it actually has very specific effects on the brain and pervasive effects throughout the life cycle. So I think it's important, just as our previous speaker spoke, that the mental health impacts are very diverse and very extensive.
And very serious, one ought to add, because they also include things like more aggression and violence. You kind of alluded to this or intimated about it, but it's definitely cause and effect we're talking about.
Absolutely. Heat extremes, we all kind of know this when in our colloquial language, hot under the collar, I'm so angry, my blood is boiling, or the admonition, hey, be cool, man, when we're really angry. Heat actually, but our scientific evidence supports this. We really know that heat, extreme heats impact aggression, anger, and make it much more difficult for people who are vulnerable to not being able to control their behavior to act on their aggression and anger. That has very specific impacts for domestic violence, for impacts on women and children, and I'm very concerned about that.
Robin Cooper, again, is a psychiatrist in private practice in San Francisco, co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. Paul Auerbach is professor emeritus of emergency medicine at Stanford Medical Center and co-author of Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. I want to go back to you, Professor Auerbach, and just talk about, since this was alluded to by Robin Cooper, the vulnerable populations who turn out to be, well, the most vulnerable, as one would expect. The greatest impact, in fact, on health, on physical health, is on poor people and on the youngest and the oldest, but also on minority communities and on immigrants and homeless and disabled.
Absolutely. And that's been well studied. And before I address that, I'd just like to go back for a second and just add to what Robin said, because there's a whole nother large overlay on this mental health issue, which relates to socially disadvantaged populations, which is this general increase in cultural anxiety. People are feeling somewhat helpless in the face of this. And having been a disaster responder in the past, you walk into really nasty situations and it can seem overwhelming, and you can question your ability to do anything. And I think we're facing that now a little bit. And part of this, because it's not necessarily a happy talk, is to be real, but to say there are absolutely things that we can do that might not have immediate effect, but if we all pull together in unprecedented ways based on modern times and the political situation, we can make progress and we can start to turn things around. I don't want people to give up hope. But
well,
back
let's
to your
hear
question.
What specifically you're talking about here, because we need that hope. I think you're absolutely right in bringing it up here, because you can get really down just thinking about what we're talking about.
Well, this is a problem we can solve for if we have the will to solve for it. It's not a zero-sum game. I think we have to start looking at the fact that we're going to need to make changes just with regard to the climate in how we approach our economic system, some of the industries that we support, and the changes that we'll have to make in the way that people live their lives in order to protect them and to reverse the degradation that we're imposing on the planet. And that takes a collective will. It takes functional governments. It takes citizen response. It takes pulling ourselves up now and realizing that we're in the biggest battle that we've ever faced. This is uncharted territory. So I'm not laying blame anywhere. I'm saying, okay, we've got a problem. Now let's bring the best and brightest minds together and let's deal with it. And as you said, it affects disproportionately people who can't take care of themselves. It's hard to argue with someone not to burn fuel in a kerosene stove when they need to do that to survive. So we have to give people alternatives. We have to be able to present people that are displaced with places to live and health care and hope and respect and all the social determinants of health that go into having a functioning, properly oriented society.
And a big caveat, I think, from you, Dr. Cooper, is don't panic.
Don't panic. The Chronicle put out a piece this weekend about panic. Let me just address, and I can't agree more fully with the comments that have already been made. But let me go back to some of these distress syndromes that I think we're all kind of preoccupied with now. This kind of umbrella term, it's a shorthand, climate, eco-anxiety, climate anxiety. That's a shorthand term for lots and lots of big feelings. And it is absolutely appropriate for us to have anxiety, worry. Our brains are wired for us to have intense feelings when there are threats. And this is a real threat.
In fact, I learned a new term thanks to your research. Salastagia, this is a new term. Well, it's an important term. It's about existential grief and psychic distress that people feel over, well, the concern over their homeland and the environmental changes that have to do also with child psychological development, those kinds
right.
of things.
Right. The scolathalgia, it's a fancy word, and it relates to that intense distress that from nostalgia, looking back on what used to be, that intense grief when we experience the lack of ability to soothe ourselves from our environment and those soothing places that we used to get solace from. That's only one component. And I think we're seeing much more now people who are in acute states of worry and anxiety. And as I say, those are the feelings that alert us to do something when we're in danger. The trouble is when the emotions are so big, so intense, so overwhelming that we can't contain them into manageable ways to respond. We also have brains that can be planful and strategic. And that's really important to engender that sense that there are things we can do and that we can make a difference in important ways, both in soothing these very, very big feelings. But I'm not also in the game of just let's feel good. I want us to translate that big energy from big feelings into effective action. Yeah.
No, I'm with you there, and I think Dr. Auerbach is, and many of our listeners are. But just from a mental health standpoint, this can be overwhelming when you think about really what we're all facing here. I mean, particularly when you're thinking about, well, children and the future, and when young people are thinking about their future and so forth, it can be downright depressing, and is for many people, as you've discovered, no doubt, in your practice.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
I see this in my practice. I see this in my practice mostly when there's an intrusion from some awful event that has just happened. Parents who came in, a mom.
Some sense of what you tell your patients, and I want to go to Professor Auerbach because I know he wants in here. I mean, some specific tools that people can have other than, you know, I can exercise my will. I can do something and maybe compel yourself in that fashion toward action.
It's not what I tell my patients. It's not that I tell my patients. That's not my job as a psychotherapist. My job with a psychotherapist is to listen, understand, validate, and help them to contain their feelings so that they can translate that into effective ways to make a difference in behaviors in their lives and in the worlds they live in.
We have the same vocation.
It's the scope of psychotherapy. We can help, but psychotherapy isn't the place
for
solutions.
It has to come from them. I understand. Dr. Auerbach, you want it in here.
Well, I'm with that 100% because I think I'm going to say it just a slightly different way, and that is, in my experience, action is the overwhelming solution to the inert behaviors that we see when people get depressed. It's getting them up out of bed. It's getting them to begin to engage in the activities of daily living, and it's to find solutions through self-help and through empowerment. So this all comes to how do we begin to relate to each other in a less polarizing fashion? How do we get climate change to be a problem that we all are going to face through whatever means we have, through our expertise, through our governments, et cetera. The medical profession is starting to step up big time to support mm-hmm. this. We certainly need our governments to step up and begin to put aside their relentless differences and start to act in a functioning way to support the people that they were elected to support. We need to integrate environmental responsibility into our own lives. Granted, that won't have the same impact as reforming the fossil fuel industry, but it gets everybody on the same page about the importance of it. And I would say the single most important factor is to take a personal responsibility for your fellow human beings. It's really easy to step back and say it's not my problem, but it is our problem.
No, I think those are very good and important and valuable sentiments. The fact is, though, there's so much that we have no control over when we're talking about extreme events like hurricanes and floods and the effect that they have on people psychologically or the destruction that it causes and wreaks in people's lives. These are things that, along with pollution and along with some of the other things that we've touched upon here, that we don't have that many things in our toolkits to fight against. I think that's where it becomes so frustrating for many people. And your thoughts, Dr. Cooper?
I actually don't see it that way. I actually think when we're stuck in it is so big, all of the things that you've outlined, that promotes a kind of psychological defensive retreat. There's nothing I can do. I might as well back off. I actually don't think that's true. I think that there are many, many ways, and I strongly think that both for managing our own feelings, but also for effective involvement in the many, many ways that collaboratively add up, there is an incredible importance to fend off the kind of hopelessness you've outlined.
Can you fend off a hurricane psychologically?
No, but you can act. And you can act in ways that are collaborative with other people. The worst thing to do is to retreat into personal isolation. The most healing thing to do is to engage with others in shared action. I want a brilliant psychological intervention from our leader, Nancy Pelosi. Don't agonize, organize. And there is a place for everyone to move with groups of people outside of that isolation in many ways to have contributions. I think it's like viewing a puzzle, and there are pieces of the puzzle that all add up together.
And that can go across the board, Paul Auerbach, with advice we're getting, and I think it's sound advice from Robin Cooper, about, for example, we have to worry about our nutrition, because food is being affected by climate change. We have to worry about such things as children and how they're going to be born into this world and the effect on pregnancies and so forth. She's talking about collaborative efforts and really talking about people putting their best feet forward, and that helps in almost every domain.
Well, I'm more of a blocker and tackler, so I agree with everything she said, and that's the rallying cry. But we have to do many things simultaneously. But if I was asked to just divide it into two basic approaches to this. Number one is we need to fix, curtail, modify what we're doing to ruin the environment. But at the same time, you've mentioned there are some things that are inevitable. If we do everything perfectly, mm-hmm. if we don't put another molecule of carbon dioxide into the air for the next 30 years, we're still going to have warming and sea level rise. So I work in the emergency department. I see it coming. It's already here. And so we have to have effective mitigation strategies for what's inevitable. And that's where entities like the National Center for Disaster Medicine and Public Health come in. That's where we get good advice out to people. That's where we fireproof communities. That's where we start to deal with the actual crises that we're facing now. We can't just fix the future. We're mm-hmm. going to have to deal with the present.
And I'm going to give out our phone number because I know there are many of you who would like to join this conversation, or if you have questions or comments, you can certainly be part of the program. Have you been experiencing physical or mental health problems due to a changing climate? We want to hear from you, and you can give us a call right now. The toll-free number to reach us at is 866-733-6786. Let me give that number again, 866-733-6786. And you can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. I'm going to read some comments that are coming in. Nick tweets, "As a parent of two, the anxiety for me is real." Another listener writes, "I'm sitting here sneezing and blowing my nose into a hanky due to extreme allergies, which I've never had in my long life until just this year." And Anne writes, "Every discussion on climate change must include a discussion of what we personally can do today. Examples: eat a vegan diet most of the time, no food waste, buy less stuff, especially clothing, get solar panels, donate to climate charities, plant trees, use less water. What else? Please advise." Well, what else, Dr. Paul Auerbach?
That was a pretty good list. So running the table on climate impacts, preparedness for me is at the very top of the list. So we know a lot about wildfires. We know a lot about extreme weather events, when they come, how they come, and we should all be prepared to deal with them, whether that involves creating defensible space around a home in the event of being near the wildland-urban interface, or it has implications for having a go bag and emergency supplies in the event of a weather disaster. It involves knowing what the air quality index is and when you should be outside and when you shouldn't be outside. Having personal supplies like N95 masks for the appropriate situations. And all the things that we can do as individuals that are climate smart and won't further contribute to the situation. Those are all very important. But again, if I was going to quadruple down on a single one right now, it would be recognizing the risk and being prepared to deal with it.
Well, Robin Cooper, we're coming up on a break, but I want to get your response to a listener question from Wendy, actually a comment. She says, "I want our leaders and CEOs to panic." You said don't panic, but she writes, "I want them to share our anxiety and take action. It's time for them to stop being complacent and take responsibility for this mess. They need to be freaking out with us."
I couldn't agree more.
So panic to a degree for the leader.
To feel it, to act on that urgency.
And we'll come back and we'll hear from more of you, our listeners, Dr. Paul Auerbach with us, Dr. Robin Cooper, and talking about how climate change could make us all sicker, and also talking about ways perhaps to make us not only feel better, but maybe do something about it. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the mental and physical health effects from climate change with Paul Auerbach. He's professor emeritus of emergency medicine at Stanford at their medical center and co-author of Enviromedics, which is subtitled The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And Robin Cooper is here in studio, psychiatrist in private practice in San Francisco and co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. And let me go right to your phone calls. Let us not tarry here. And we begin, David, with you. You're on. Good morning.
Am I the David that is on from Berkeley?
Yes, you are the David that is on from Berkeley.
Yes. I'm concerned that we're not paying enough attention to adaptation to climate change. In our case, it's rising temperatures. We ought to be using that cap-and-trade money instead of for high-speed rail on giving subsidies to poor people to buy air conditioning to make sure everybody has enough air conditioning so they don't have to worry about the heat, at least when they're indoors.
Right back to preparation with David's call. Let me go to Dr. Auerbach. Paul Auerbach?
There are definitely mechanical and structural things we can do to prepare for all the eventualities. So let's use heat as an example. Yes, there are ways to cool homes. There are ways to build shelters. I haven't done a thorough economic analysis to know what's possible, but along the lines of what I said previously about getting ready, there's no question about it. The heat waves are going to come, and so we have to be ready for them. The fires are going to come. We have to be ready for them, et cetera. So to the extent that providing subsidies or providing physical modifications to homes is a solution, that should be explored, as should every other possible solution.
Let me pick up on this just for a moment, if I may, with you, Professor Auerbach, because extreme weather is affecting critical medical supplies, and we know that now. There's evidence of prescription medication actually causing harm because of these heat problems. What to do in a preparatory sense about that? Some ideas from you, if we could?
It's going to be a more global response, Michael, which is that we can dissect the climate change impact on the health delivery system, on the health of human beings, and on supply chain issues. Those can all be anticipated and likely to a certain degree mitigated. But what we haven't yet appreciated is that we're going to have to rethink entire systems. Let's look at first responders. Firefighters, law enforcement, the military are spectacular when it comes to getting in and helping people. However, that's predicated on them having a manageable number of problems at any one time to deal with. So it's one thing if you have one fire or two fires going, but if we start having these events simultaneously, citizens can't expect that the cavalry is always going to arrive in a timely fashion. And so we have to rethink how we educate the public to make them effective first responders. Again, I do disaster response, so I might get in a day or two after it happens, but really a lot of the fate and future of a community and human lives are determined in the first 24 to 48 hours. And so we have to be ready to take care of ourselves.
And Dr. Cooper, just let me go to a question here. You want to respond first?
Yeah, I want to respond to that. I think it's a really important thing, and it really reframes disaster response to a very, very broader area. In psychiatry, we think about that as building community resilience and neighborhood resilience. And that means investing in the ideas around disaster response before they happen, so that we are ready in connected ways in communities to be able to care for ourselves when the disasters that we know will happen arrive. It's a whole different conceptual model. And I think both in many of these discussions, we've been talking a lot both about being prepared for what we're experiencing and expected to, but we can't also leave out how we address what we know is the root cause. And so we have a very complex set of being prepared now to respond to the things that will happen and not ignoring that the root causes really relate to our dependence on oil and gas, the fossil fuel industry. We have to do both simultaneously.
Yeah, I like what you say about preparation and tying it to responsiveness and action, but I wonder what you say to a listener here who says, can climate change anxiety cause apathy because the issues involved are so overwhelming? I've heard friends express, what's the point of doing anything? We're all doomed anyway.
That is the absolute truth. When we are faced with such big feelings and the problem seems so enormous, the potential for retreating to live your life day by day, to say, I can't do anything, and to protect oneself from these horrific feelings is to retreat into a kind of paralysis and hopelessness. And that, I think, is really toxic and really problematic. We need to be able psychologically to hold that there are real things, that there are real losses that will be, to be able to grieve that and tolerate those feelings, but not have the feelings be so extreme that they put us in that state of paralysis. Because, as Paul previously said, there are things we can do and things we can do now that will impact how severely we are impacted in the future.
And again, Robin Cooper is a psychiatrist in private practice here in Sacramento and co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. Pardon?
San Francisco, not Sacramento.
Did I say Sacramento? No, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
We can take some of the issues to Sacramento.
Well, we have listeners in Sacramento, so trust me.
And I'm embarrassed that I haven't met Robin before. So there's action that you can do in your daily life, you know, eat less meat, drive an electric car.
Actually, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but I'm looking at some pushback that says, to go against Paul Auerbach, we do control the oil industry by purchasing gasoline. Switch to an electric vehicle or just do everything you can to reduce the amount you spend on gasoline. It's not the oil industry that's buying and driving our gas guzzlers. We are.
Well, that is true, but on a limited basis, and I appreciate that comment. But, you know, our economic system and our use of fossil fuels underlies virtually every industry we have. So any industry needs to look at how they get their energy resources. And, you know, we have a dependence on this. And again, I'm not laying blame. We've just never been here before. When we wrote this book 2 years ago, we thought we were writing it to convince people that there was a problem, and to a certain extent, we were. That would not be the reason to write this book now. It would be to dig in deeper on the actual issues and recognize that people believe that we have a problem and to try and start to show them solutions. What can an individual do who feels helpless in their own personal life? Well, they can aggregate. They can vote. They can create education programs. There are a lot of things we can do together that we might not be able to do apart, and there's strength in numbers. So very good for Robin's statement. There's a lot we can do.
I want to go to more calls because there are a lot of people who want to get involved in this conversation, but I was just thinking about a passage from your book since you mentioned it, and the book is called Enviromedics, the Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. At one point you say, hot and dry go hand in hand. As temperatures climb and rainfall diminishes, the landscape changes. And the landscape changes means wildfires increase and seasons are longer, and we have all these problems that we've been talking about here. Let me go to more of our callers, though, and let me bring in Alina here. Alina, you're on. Morning.
Hey there. Good morning. Thank you for the discussion. So I really resonate with the existential anxiety and depression resulting from climate change and the global migration crisis, along with the Trump administration's treatment of migrants, mm-hmm. kind of sent me over the edge. And then I found mm-hmm. out that there are thousands of ICE detainees across the country who can get out on parole if they have sponsors who are American citizens. So my partner and I are currently in the process of sponsoring a young person from Honduras, and he should be arriving with us in the next week or so.
Well, good luck with that, and thank you for the call. Let me bring another caller aboard. That's Alicia. Alicia, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. This is such essential work. You know, as your speakers are aware, we've been so crystal clear on the science around climate change for 30-plus years. And so I think we have to look at why there has been a collective inaction and denial. And I think actually looking at the emotional qualities of it are so, so essential. And I'm an artist based here in San Francisco, but I do this work nationally and internationally, working to help people recognize all the feelings and experiences that we're all having as the climate's changing, that we don't have the words to talk about. You guys brought up solastalgia, which is a word that was coined by Glenn Albright, you know, in 2002. And that word is like one word to talk about these things, but it's a vessel that has to hold a lot of feelings and new experiences. So anyhow, we work with the public to name these things, and it's incredible how so many people go from feeling alone and isolated in their feelings around this to feeling like, oh, there's a word for this now, and they can talk about it with people. So I think it's essential for getting collective action to do emotional work.
Alicia, I appreciate your thoughts, and thank you for the call. And here's some more emotions. I'll go to you, Robin Cooper. Bill writes, What I feel is anger at the economic and political institutions failing us in the face of the climate change that they have wrought. Please don't tell me to change my lifestyle or protect my house. How do we get the systemic change needed to turn back this disaster? One has to mention, by the way, that the most powerful man in the world, who now sits in the White House and is president of the United States, thinks it's all a hoax made up by the Chinese.
Your anger is completely appropriate. The range of feelings are appropriate to the kind of horrible threat that we're feeling. The task is to translate those big feelings into effective action. And it's my belief, I really strongly think that individual ways that we live our lives are incredibly important to this, but it also can kind of fool us that's where the change is going to happen. And I really believe people have to translate that anger, that grief, that anxiety into bringing together in groups of people ways to both feel the feelings and then move beyond that into actions that have direct impacts on solutions.
And we'll go to more calls. We bring Lena in as our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think my comment dovetails really well with what was just said. I'm an artist, and I feel like it's so important right now that we change the narrative, or that we work on shifting a narrative into one of even this possibility of, like, what if what we're facing could even be this sort of incredible opportunity for us to imagine and invent new ways of living on Earth, and also, going back to previous ways that we lived on Earth that were more sustainable. Like, I think it's really easy for people just to feel overwhelmed by what's happening right now. And instead, there really is this, like, incredible opportunity for artists, engineers, scientists to, for all of us to come together and just shift the way we're living on the planet and come up with new ways of living with what we're facing, and that it could even be like an exciting or, just sort of imaginatively powerful.
The challenge of reimagining, I think, is what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, and just also taking it, what if this was like an opportunity for something amazing to happen? Never talk about that. We always, and I understand, because really terrible things are happening and have happened and could happen, but it also could be this just like incredible opportunity to like reinvent how we're living in a way that could be fun. It could be, I just think there is a way that we can shift our thinking about it and the narrative around it.
All right. I appreciate that thought, and I thank you for the call. And we'll go right to another caller, and that's Ann in Oakland. Ann, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. This is such a great program. One note is that it is a little bit still preaching to the choir. We've had this kind of, my question is about anxiety and the fact that, we have these leaders in the government and industry, not just in this country, but worldwide, who either want to deny the climate change or, otherwise ignore it because of interest in personal profit. And so, how do we deal with that anxiety? And then just to sort of tag on to that, this problem, I think, can date back to the beginning of the industrial age. It's not new. We've been in this mode of use resources, dump them wherever for centuries. So I think, the systemic change has to be much bigger than just the most recent manifestation of our issues. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. Let me go back to you, Professor Auerbach, on that.
Thank you. First of all, great comments, and you're right. And I don't know how normal I am, but I have normal emotions, and I get cynical too. I'm very motivated to do something, but I share exactly what the caller just said. We have to make big fixes. And I'm fearful. What is my fear? My fear is that it will take a couple major catastrophes, maybe more than just a couple, where there's a lot of destruction and life lost, before our political system and our combined political economic system will understand that the ball is entirely in their court.
Alas, we tend to be more, reactive than proactive. That tends to
In the emergency department, you know, every story about how why someone's there begins with how they got into trouble. People find religion with regard to their personal health and injury prevention when something has happened to them. So we know that it's difficult to preach safety. It's difficult to get people to do things proactively ahead of time. Does that mean we should stop? No. What should everybody that's on this call doing? Yes, to a certain extent, we're preaching to the choir. But for others who haven't contemplated this before, we should hold our legislators accountable. We should make them articulate sensible, reasonable plans for getting us from here to there. The world has to decide how it wants to live. The planet will be here. It's just a question of what it will be populated with. And so if we want to change things, then we have to change things. And it won't be easy, and it's going to take a while, but it is still entirely possible.
Well, as long as we keep talking about preaching to the choir, I want to go back to Robin Cooper, who, because here's a listener, Charlie, who says, Robin Cooper, how do we work with the adults in our family and communities who do not get it about climate change as an emergency?
Actually, I think that that's an incredibly important question. And when you're addressing we're preaching to the choir, I think what we do is translate the impacts that we know into real palpable ways that people experience it in their lives. And I think that's through their health. I think we need to translate the language and the way we're talking to the people who don't know and experience it already in terms of health consequences. And those are the places that people feel it in their guts. When their kids can't breathe, when their grandmother is found dead in her locked-in apartment because of extreme heat. We talk about the ways this affects you in your with health. And I think we bring it beyond those communities that are already pretty active. And I think the group that I particularly work with regularly discusses and brings this to Republican legislators in specific legislative actions throughout at the national level. I work with Citizens Climate Lobby. Beyond that, I think it is really important to have the conversations where people experience it in their lives and make the connection and not be preaching and not send people to a kind of retreat, but finding those common grounds.
I like that call particularly. It says maybe we have to look at things through a completely different lens and have to use imaginations and creativity here to really think outside the box, as a cliche would have it. And let me get another caller here. We've got Cece on with a medical question. Cece, please join us. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, when you say breathing, I'm somebody with severe asthma. In my case, I got it late. I was exposed to some chemicals and it eventually developed into a very severe case. So I live and breathe this, and I live in Silicon Valley. And in the last few years, it's just been horrific for me to try to deal with this on a daily basis when every breath I take reminds me of the problem. I would, you know, when people talk about creativity, I think what the government should do and industry should do is come together and say, we're going to offer a monetary incentive to whoever can solve these problems. You know, get award prizes. Some woman came up with a way to turn plastic into diesel fuel. Now that's one. It's a big step from where it really should be, but it's still a step. And there are all these innovations going on all the time. And so, even school kids, you know, sometimes come up with these brilliant ideas. So that's a thought.
Okay, thank you. And there are more. There are prizes out there that are available. In fact, foundations and the like have offered those things. Paul Auerbach, let me go back to you, though, because infectious diseases are increasing, heart and lung disease with more air pollution. And you've also got And apropos of that last call, you've got the American Lung Association saying that climate change is like sunburn on our lungs. Again, one has to ask about how can one can be best prepared for these kinds of events. And when the caller says that it's just getting worse for her with breathing, well, that raises some serious concerns as well, profound concerns.
Absolutely. And there are some things that you can do personally to avoid bad air days and wear masks. But we're going to run up to limits where that won't be enough. And that's the whole issue of climate migration. Mm-hmm. So we're familiar with large populations of people that have to move because of heat and drought largely. People are going to be forced to move.
Yeah, let me in fact go to this comment, and I'll go to you, Robin Cooper. Roberto says, as we consider the impact of climate change, I think the mental health scenario must include migration as a result of climate change and its impact on the mental health of migrant and refugee populations. Please speak to these connections and the need for more public awareness of the connections between them.
Absolutely. When you can no longer live in your own home, when your community is decimated, if the fragmentation of connections to the people who are close to you are enormous, the psychic destruction is incredibly painful, and we're already seeing that. We're seeing that at our borders, but we've already had in the United States two major populations that are being displaced, a Native American community in the Bayou in Louisiana and another population in Alaska. The destruction to communities has profound impacts, and the resultant isolation is enormous.
I have to come back to leadership here, too. You have a president of the United States who is on record as saying these migrants should be shot. We can build moats with alligators and rattlesnakes. You can't make this stuff up. I mean, it's coming right from the White House.
You know, the kind of hate that comes back when we are threatened is just so painful and enormous.
Here's another caller. Jim is joining us next from Santa Cruz. Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks very much. I just want to lend some credence to some of the comments Dr. Kruger has been mentioning. I'm a nurse practitioner now, but for 30-some years I was a wildland firefighter, and now I work in counseling firefighters under critical incident stress management. And I just want to say that there's been such an increase in the amount of stress, anxiety, and depression among firefighters that lead to further problems down the road with divorce and just family issues. And it is because of the stress involved with combating some of these incredible firefighters. I mean, these fires. In 30 years, I've never had such experience in fighting fires like this, and what they face now is just daunting. So that's just my comment. Thanks very much.
And I thank you for that comment.
May I respond? I have a very personal interest in this. My son-in-law is a wildfire fighter, and the impacts on these brave guys, men and women who go out to protect us, is enormous. But the impacts on them when they are not working directly is incredible. And the increase in alcoholism and depression is one of the things that we're seeing.
Same holds true for police work. It holds true for those who are doing, you know, emergency work and so forth. I want to just...
Yeah, Michael, and we'll be studying that. Mm-hmm. We're actually designing a study now to evaluate, in particular, firefighters, both physically and emotionally, to see what the magnitude is of the problems they face, and then to start to try and design mitigation efforts around that.
I want to go, in the time remaining, to specific recommendations that each of you have. You certainly talked about action, about collective and community cooperation and interaction and so forth. But let me first read a couple of comments that, in my judgment at least, reflect kind of the spectrum that we're talking about here. One is from a listener named Aaron who writes, we have four kids. Two of them have decided not to have kids of their own because they don't think there's any reason to bring children in a world that's getting to be barely livable. So we are experiencing our own set of grief at the thought that we might never have grandchildren. And then on the other side of things, we're hearing from a lot of listeners with specific, again, modes of action. Kim writes, the 2020 vote is imperative. Get involved. Educate. Go to vulnerable states to canvass. Also, eat well and consciously. Exercise outside in nature. Meditate. Belong to groups of like-minded people. All of this helps. So let's find out from both of you what you think really can help here. We'll go first to you, Dr. Auerbach.
This is Earth's project. If we want to solve this problem, it's going to take everybody, everything. And so we need to devote nearly constant attention to possible solutions. And if I was going to go for the big bang for the buck, I would say it's who we elect. Mm-hmm. And that has to be a high priority. We have to hold our government accountable for getting on board.
Robin Cooper?
I can't agree anymore. I think that what has been said by the caller was incredibly important. It's how we live our lives, but how we translate that into policies. And that means our leaders have to be responsive, and that means we are responsible for who we elect. I can't think of anything more pro-health than working on this election.
Well, there's also, we've got seconds left here, but a listener named Alex who says, my partner and I are looking to contribute to organizations that mitigate climate change. Any suggestions from either of you?
Well, I'd push my organization that is as poor as we can be, Climate Psychiatry Alliance.
Any did you would add,
personal.
Paul
Arbaugh?
I would support your local communities and the social services that support the people that are most in need.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us. Robin Cooper, again, is a psychiatrist in private practice in San Francisco and also co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance. Dr. Paul Auerbach is professor emeritus of emergency medicine at Stanford University Medical Center and co-author of Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Thank you for being with us this morning's forum program, and for all of us here, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.